Welcome back to the program. We are continuing our conversation about this week's IPCC report with someone who is an insider on that topic. He is Professor Stephen Schneider, and he teaches biological sciences at Stanford University, also a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for International Studies and co-director of the Center for Environmental Science and Policy. And he is also co-director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Environment and Resources. Boy, that's a mouthful. And last but not least, he is on the Synthesis Committee for the IPCC report. Stephen Schneider, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Betsy. And the reason for all that alphabet soup of what I do is that we still at universities, even modern ones like Stanford, don't have departments of problems like climate change. And they're interdisciplinary, and you have to put things together across groups, and that's why we do it the way we do it.
Absolutely. Well, you are over-credentialed, I'd say, certainly very well-informed and obviously a perfect person to talk about this, and that's the type of resume we like to consult on climate change, unlike people like CNN's Glenn Beck, who's talking about Al Gore being, well, let's not even say it. I can't even say it. Anyway, you're here to tell us what we expect from this IPCC report, Part 3, expected to be released later this week.
Well, remember what IPCC does is it doesn't tell the world what to do. That's what they would call policy prescriptive. That's the job of decision makers, ranging from everybody out there when they decide what car or refrigerator to buy to government officials trying to figure out what industries to support and what industries they should tax. So that choice we're not going to do. But what we will do is we'll survey the literature out there, all the papers written, summarize the arguments of various sides from the coal industry to the deep enviro groups, and then we'll go beyond that and we'll talk about the scientific merits in those arguments and try to give people choices so that they're not just stuck out there listening to special interests telling you it's the end of the world and good for you, the two lowest probability outcomes. What the current report is doing is talking about how much is it going to cost to fix it and who pays.
Mm. Were you surprised by anything contained in the first two IPCC reports?
Well, basically, the first report, which gives you what's happened and what is projected, I sort of call that the report, what will happen. And that didn't have any major surprises other than the word unequivocal to describe the global warming of the last century. Scientists are a conservative bunch. They never use words like unequivocal unless the evidence is really clear, and it was really unequivocal. Now they start to hedge a little bit. They say, well, it's only very likely, better than 90% chance, that most of the last 50 years of warming is due in large part to the humans using the atmosphere as a free sewer to dump our waste, our tailpipe and smokestack waste. So that was pretty strong stuff, though not unexpected. The next report, the one I was in, the Working Group 2 report, basically is the So What report. You know, and there was good news. You're going to increase possibly crop yields in high northern latitudes and longer growing seasons. And if you melt the Arctic sea ice, it's cheaper for the shipping industry to go. But it wrecks the Inuit culture, destroys the polar bear ecosystem, and changes the world's climate. So now you have a juggling act about, well, what do you care more about the species on Earth and about small groups that have done nothing to create the problem whose entire culture or worse is wiped out, or only about the return on investment to the polluters? We don't answer that question. We point it out. Now the current report, the third one, that deals with the therefore what. And what they're saying is we can fix this problem, or at least 80% of it, but it won't be free, although there are a lot of cheap initial things to do, like use energy efficiently and performance standards on refrigerators and put cars on a diet. And they analyze the costs of those and who pays and how effective we can be.
So does it both outline technical measures as well as policy recommendations?
Well, technical measures don't just happen by themselves. As much as we like to think that our creative genius occurs in the shower under that nice, pleasant hot water or at dinner with friends, and it does in part, what we invent depends upon how much we invest. The old joke is you can't have learning by doing without doing and return on investment without investment. So the policy part is setting up the rules and the incentives such that the private sector, where the capacity to invent our way out of this problem exists, but they have to have incentives because they don't like doing speculation. They like high returns. So we need public-private partnerships to help them get over the hump. And also we have to work with developing countries so that they leapfrog over the old polluting ways and don't just copy us 50 years late.
Now, given that more than 100 countries participate in the IPCC reports, how likely are nations to adopt the ideas recommended since it is a consensus document and it is widespread across the globe?
Now, when you and I have a conversation with a group, we say, what's the family consensus? We generally mean 4 out of 5. We don't mean everybody necessarily. In the UN, they mean everybody. So it does boil down to lowest common denominator language. And when people say, oh, the IPCC governments are spinning the report to be more radical than the scientists want, it's in fact rather the opposite, because you also have to convince the Chinese who want to burn coal just like we did to get rich, and the Saudis who want to sell oil at all costs, as well as to convince the small island states who see their culture and their livelihood disappearing as the sea level rises. We have to adjudicate across all those points of view and still retain a reasonably honest representation of the science. So it's a very grueling process. That having been said, and by the way, scientists hate that because they like to argue evidence and not national preconceptions. So we don't give in when it's wrong, then they don't sign, and we're stuck in stalemates till 4 a.m. every day. In the end, though, when the 100 governments finally can live with the compromise that's both scientifically accurate and at the same time spins it the way they can live with, they now have ownership. You'll never solve a problem like global warming where everybody contributes without ownership and cooperation. And so the process is worth it.
And bottom line, in our last minute, the consequences of doing nothing far outweigh any costs to be invested.
Well, the consequences of doing nothing range, if we're very lucky, another couple of a degrees warming, that is more Katrinas and forest fires in California and species going extinct to the loss of the polar bear ecosystem. That's if we're very lucky. If we're very unlucky, we're looking at 5 to 10 in Fahrenheit degrees warming. That's a temperature difference between an ice age and an interglacial happening 100 times faster. Utterly catastrophic. So we are facing a threat to the life support system of the Earth. Nobody's certain we aren't going to be lucky and have it only bad, or we're going to be unlucky and have it catastrophic. So it's time to start slowing it down, and that's what's beginning to happen everywhere, even inside the West Wing.
Well said, and thank you so much for your work, Professor Stephen Schneider, and for joining us on EcoTalk.
Well, thank you, Betsy. I always enjoy listening to you.
Thank you. We've been speaking with one of the world's experts on climate change here in the Bay Area at Stanford University. I don't have time to give you all his titles, but it'll be on our website. We'll be right back with a chef who's fighting for you to eat the freshest, healthiest salmon that an ecosystem can produce.